Well, the Nazis versus the Jews, it goes back to the different kinds of propaganda that we were talking about. You were talking like a top-down hierarchical, like corporate kind of thing that the Nazis used, even though they're using mystical powers to pull off that, as anyone would. Then there's the Jewish method is completely different. It's like it's spread out and based on arrangement, you know.
Well, that's all. I
And
mean, the Jewish method is
like more of a war of words, like make your words count, make your agreements, you know, the follow the law. You know, it's the difference between like the law as an idea and the law as a cop with a billy club, you know. It's kind of the difference between like you know, the legislative and judicial executive branch, you know. If you're thinking about
I like how our forefathers were supposed to be like all about like religious freedom, basically, you know, and but then you have like Masonry's like foundation happens to be like completely Kabbalistic, which becomes, and it's actually like theosophical in its whole approach. It just borrows from all these places and plays with them and makes them all malleable. Like that's just like Kubrick. Like that's
that's
so
just
funny.
like it's just like a American culture too. I mean, like Chris, the whole, like, you know, it's not just the Bible. Like the Christianity is not just the Bible and going to church, but also like Christmas trees and Santa Claus and all this other weird stuff, you know, like, or like, you know, the Catholic cathedrals, like the Virgin Mary paintings and all this sort of all these things that just make up the environment that, you know, people's ideas and, you know, spirits exist in.
Sure. And I mean the
And
Western
it borrows from different cultures. That's how it, like, borrowing and lending. I mean, that's the whole thing that, you know, like the Jewish money lenders, they were the only people allowed to, but you had to have them, otherwise you couldn't lend it, you couldn't get any money change, you couldn't travel, you know, like.
It's still illegal. It's been illegal, and it's still illegal for a Jew to loan with interest another Jew, but they can loan
Really?
with interest a Gentile.
But my point is that you need these are arrangements and agreements which have created a global culture. Not a culture that's based on like, well, we're, I mean, the ironic and sad thing is that just because of, you know, socio-political geographic arrangements, like Israel is like now like a fortress town, which is exactly what the whole point was, try to avoid that kind of thing by like using travel and arrangements and the law to like create a culture that can survive anything. Anything, you throw anything at it, and like it's going to survive because it's not defending anything.
We give
There's
Israel
no fortress.
more military aid than like anywhere in the world, and it's one of the smallest places in the world. So that's kind of interesting. But we don't need to get into a whole political thing here, which can,
I'm just trying to observe
I'm saying that to myself.
Not really making any comment, you know.
Exactly. We could take this back to what we were talking about before. I mean, basically, all the people in The Shining who make a specific argument, the person who says this is about the moon landing, well, then he has to defend that position. Anything that comes out against that position, he has to either challenge or deal with or whatever. And they've forgotten how to be fluid, and that by having a position that you have to defend all the time, you've already lost.
Well,
I wouldn't necessarily agree with that, because if you strongly defend a correct position for long enough, there'll be a mountain of evidence behind you to prove it, even if you build it up only one droplet at a time. And I mean, for instance, before this conversation, I was thinking about the title of the film, obviously the 237 being in there, and what does that mean? And I found out, I messaged this to John last night. I don't know. Have you guys heard of the Great Moon Hoax?
What?
Have you guys heard of the Great Moon Hoax of 1835?
Nope.
Well, apparently there were seven articles, or no, I'm sorry, six articles, one every day, published in a New York newspaper beginning on August 25th, 1835. And they claimed to have seen that there was a society living on the moon, either on or inside the moon. These articles are lengthy, and they're written in a kind of a post-Victorian or pre-Victorian language, so they're kind of dense. But anyway, this is the August 25th is the 237th day of the year. Now, if you take Jay Wiedner's idea that there's the whole film is about a moon hoax, and you correlate this to the fact that August 25th, 1835, it also has this clue about a moon hoax. I think that's an interesting clue that's worth looking at. And the funny thing about it is that the people up there are bats, right? They're bats. So there's this symbol of a bat, because the idea from The Shining, originally they were croquet mallets, right? Or roque mallets, as they call them. So, some folks call them, but it was more like a hammer almost. And that's an interesting symbol in and of itself. So the fact that he changed it to a bat is interesting, because you have this idea of these bat people living on the moon being promulgated on the 237th day of the year. And I think Kubrick would have known about this moon hoax, basically. Because whether or not, and I don't accept the theory that The Shining is about is the moon hoax. That's ridiculous to do so. It's extremely superficial to do so. But it's in a very important principle, and it might be close to a central principle in regards to what the film's about, is this... the mystery of the moon.
But I think that one angle that people gloss over and don't really take into account with the moon theories of Jay Wiedner is the natural extension of, if that's true, is that Kubrick was in tune or in touch with one of the greatest conspiracies the world has ever known. So, you know, whatever the moon hoax is, let's say he did film it, it's that this man who continued to make Hollywood movies was in possession of knowledge and helped, was complicit with one of the greatest conspiracies of all time. What does that say to Kubrick is that he's not your average film director. He's not your average artist. This guy is plugged into history. And he's plugged into a knowledge of history that we all have absolutely no idea about. And I think that kind of element to the whole argument is essential to Wiedner's whole rap. Exactly. And that, you know, the other thing about Wiedner that I think is lost is his whole alchemical Kubrick writings, which I think are genius. I really think that his breakdown of 2001 and Kubrick's knowledge of alchemy and how it's expressed in that film is essential to trying to understand the language of these films and understanding what Kubrick was trying to communicate. That it all starts from that sort of Kubrick 101, and then if you understand Kubrick 101, it naturally leads to higher understandings of the film. And Wiedner says that it naturally includes this moon thing.
Can I just throw in one thing here? Is that there's we were talking this correlation between racism and the moon and Jay Wiedner or Wiedner. The funny thing here is that I had read some of Jay's work years ago, and then I heard him on Red Ice with his alchemical Kubrick and his whole thing, the first time he went on there to talk about it. And something that really struck me was he came off as this total Islamophobe. And I was like, wow, really? It just really kind of hit me hard that here's this guy talking about all these different ideas, and then he's talking about the threat of the Muslims coming to, you know, invade Europe and America. And I'm like, wait a second, I thought you were a conspiracy theorist. You must know that it wasn't Muslims who attacked us. Like, where the fuck are you getting this from? And whatever. So what I think is interesting, though, is of course you have the, you know, Judaism as representing Saturn, Christianity as representing the sun, and Islam representing the moon. They're the crescent. So the idea of being afraid, exactly, that's what I'm talking about. Mark just wrote it here. He's afraid of the moon. Islamic culture is lunar. That's my point, yeah.
Well, that's interesting because the symbol for
wing nuts, you know, like Obama is, you know, assumed to be Muslim. Not only Muslim, but not American.
Right.
Like his myth on the racist underworld is in the play.
Totally. I like how if you look at the symbol for Mercury, you have the moon, the sun, and the earth all in a single expression, you know? And that the essence of like what Mercury is, it's like basically malleability, being able to shape and incorporate and integrate all these aspects into a single expression, which is kind of, I think, slightly relevant to what we're looking at with like Room 237, right?
Your recent splice is actually quite good. It's humorous. There's a lot of humor in it. Very cool. I loved it.
Oh, that was this morning. So like I've been working on this for like the last like fucking, I don't know, week or something. totally regularly. But yeah, did you guys see that?
I saw it. I liked it. Yeah. Very cool.
Here, let me just.
What is it?
Here, let me show you real quick. So this doesn't give it complete justice. This is going to be blown up really long. I'm going to have, you know, this is going to be like a big wall piece. I'm going to print it, but it's just this thing here. It's actually like I didn't even.
Hello.
Hi.
Eclipse.
Cool. So as I was working on this, I didn't realize until I got to the end that it's actually an atomic bomb. So like if you look at the shape of the thing itself, and then I have this reoccurrence of the mushroom cloud symbolism throughout this. I have multiple mushroom clouds and mushrooms and all this stuff, and I don't know if you guys are looking at it, but that like kind of tripped me out because it wasn't until like I got towards the end of the piece that I like had to like stop and be like, wow, I just made a giant mushroom cloud.
You were so focused on the micro, you didn't see the macro.
But yeah.
It ended up relating.
Yeah.
I get those feelings looking at like the twins hallway scene. Like I keep seeing this face like, just in the fluctuations of light, like this human head that would fit across the entire screen. And then when I was staring at the balloon hallway scene forever, like doing that essay on it, like I finally was just like, oh my God, it's the Grail. I started seeing all these curves in these sort of like box, you know, things that are made out of straight lines, but complicated, like intricately folded straight lines. You know, like the Overlook halls are not—they're not flat. They're not like THX 1138. You know, it's like they're folded. It seems like making like that many like 90-degree turns, you eventually start making, you know, curves.
Mm-hmm. Garrett Morris mentions that the whole linear thing in the audio commentary to The Shining.
What's
that? Garrett Morris, the Steadicam operator. He's the guy who does the. I don't know if he's listening to it, but it's on the audio commentary to The Shining.
All right.
Yeah,
and he talks.
Go ahead, cut me off.
Yeah, you're pretty distorted there.
It's like a reoccurring thing with Mark, but where he turns into a robot while we're talking. It's like happens again and again.
It's the whole like, you know, circling, squaring, like maybe squaring the circle in reverse, you know. Circling the square more.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so this is something
Kubrick, I think is actually satirizing. What point is he satirizing these occult systems that he seems to be expressing? Like, what's his?
I want to address this. I was very much looking forward to having both Mark and John on the call together because, you know, Mark has done this kind of work into talking about this like Valis loop, this idea that we're stuck in a loop, and John, you're someone who's taken The Shining and played it forward and backwards on top of itself, almost representing it as a sort of infinity symbol, something along those lines. A Mobius strip is what I'm kind of picturing, right?
Right.
So I think these ideas go very much hand in hand, and I don't want to take it too far off. I'd really like to address that particular thing that you've done, but I just want to kind of take the conversation a little bit in that direction, because we spoke to someone last week, or rather 2 weeks ago, on the show, who had done a bunch of work into the correlation between Planet of the Apes and 2001 A Space Odyssey.
All right.
And, I sort of, a few days later, or actually, I guess about a week later, I had this whole dream where I saw how clearly it sort of meshed, and that there was this sort of forwards and backwards correlation between the two. You know, he makes the point that there's Planet of the Apes starts with them falling coming out of a wormhole and falling over Lake Powell, which is where it was filmed. And then you have all these apes there, you know, men in ape costumes, and then the story kind of following this trend. And with 2001, of course, at the end, it starts with the monkeys at the beginning, and then you have at the end, you have him going through the wormhole and then flying over Lake Powell. He will also point out this idea of the child, the space child or the star child, being paralleled in Planet of the Apes as the talking doll that's found in the excavated forbidden land in Planet of the Apes. And it occurred to me that cave where they're digging this up is very much excavating the monolith on the moon or whatever it is, and that's actually further exemplified by that space being the moon, because right after that he finds the Statue of Liberty, which is Isis. She is the lunar goddess, is right there. So you have this moon correlation. So I had this, at first I was picturing playing 2001 A Space Odyssey, and then when he goes through the wormhole, flipping it over to Planet of the Apes. And then I just started this was going through my mind. I had this dream where I saw that it kind of worked both forward and back and in multiple layers. And it occurred to me that this is something that you have done a lot of work into, both of you. And I just wondered if we could take the conversation a little bit in that direction to see, was this something that you just thought would be a fun experiment? And I know we're trying not to get too stuck on a specific interpretation, but assuming that you feel your experiment was successful, what do you think are the repercussions of that? You know, does that mean anything?
Well, it wasn't an experiment in that, like, I was doing, you know, studying The Shining and curious about, like, symmetries in the plot, like, and with regards to, like, time of scenes and stuff like that. Like, you know, the whole, like, excuse me, pardon me. Bathroom break. So, like, I can't hear you again, Mark.
Oh, okay, that's cool. Don't worry.
I can't hear Mark either. Just to say, I noticed, John, in your most recent set of posts on the KDK12 Tumblr, you're also talking about the idea of time being flipped. The idea that the clocks are reflecting this. And that to me seems to go have a very similar correlation with this. And I know Mark's work into not only the Valva Swoop, but Mark's recent writings on the lunar mirror and stuff like that. So.
Yeah, and to me it's also like Kubrick's, it's his folding of the of his narrative. And it's not exactly symmetrical, but it's like, it's a lot like what you described. And you're creating your collage, you know, like you made all these little applications and then realized later that there was an overall pattern.
Yeah, the big one was actually 237. So I have room 237 throughout the center of the piece reflected upon itself in three different ways, with the bathroom in the center. And then I didn't realize that at the very top of the piece itself, I had written 237, which you can't really see in this copy unless unless it's really blown up. But
the exact center top there is 237.
The exact very center top, right above Jesus Christ, it says fucking 237. Well, which is just like completely, I didn't mean to do that. Like,
237 is 12, and if you look at this as a clock, it's midnight, you know, so.
Yeah, it's crazy.
12 is the top. But now I've been thinking about, like, well, think about what. Oh, it's there too. Because I was thinking about, like, I'm working on something on time. I haven't really had enough time to focus on it completely. Which is when the first day on the month later, the first thing that's said on the Jack asks, "What time is it?" And then and then Wendy goes, "It's about 11:30." So think about 11's position in your. There's like a giant 11 right there, the two columns that are separating John Lennon doing a little blow there.
Totally. He's actually got a syringe.
And 30, it's halfway down. You know?
Yeah.
About halfway down. Not exactly 11:30, but about 11:30. So, like, Wendy puts a halfway between two points, between 11 and 12, and then also a soft, like a fuzzy logic there. It's about 11:30. There's a little bit of variance, a little bit of flex room in there.
Wow.
So if we look at the movie as like, is basically somewhere in between 11 and 12. Now 12 is room 237, but like if you do the calculation, the like typical mystical calculations on room 236, which is the room across the hall that Julie Kearns discovered, the open door there, then 2 plus 3 plus 6 is 11, and 2 times 3 times 6 is 30.
Mm-hmm.
So we have this sort of like alternate kind of like hidden female kind of mystical nature, mathematical nature in the movie, with Wendy being associated with 11, and like that, you know, like she's. Often has like two columns beside her. When we focus on Jack and his relationship to the two columns that flank his desk, it's really controversial. He's either one side, it's the other side. The chairs are disappearing. You know, like the whole thing is not for him. You know.
Yeah, it also seems like classic like poltergeist behavior, and the links between Poltergeist and The Shining are tremendous. But like the way that the chairs get moved around, you know, it's like these things feel like they're like the Overlook itself is like an organism that has a mind of its own, which I guess would probably be most people's assumption, you know.
Remember that great scene in Poltergeist when the mom is experimenting with the ghosts. And she's like made diagrams across the floor and is like, and all that. And just her thrill of being like, oh my God, it's the occult world is here. You know, like, isn't this great? And she got there like by like being kind of like scientific about it.
Yeah.
That seems very, 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 familiar feeling.
Right. There's also that the daughter has a ram's helmet on while she's sliding her across the floor, Carol Ann, you know, and the ram kind of like, she's almost like the sacrificial lamb or something, and she's like being, you know, and she's like the Shakina too, that she's put in exile, and then she comes out through the portal. It's like very, it's all just so heavy in the symbolism.
You know, to speak to the Overlook real quick, you know, when they're getting the grand tour, Allman is saying all the best people stayed here, right?
Right.
Well, they don't stay. They don't.
Before anyone knew what the jet set was.
Yeah, but they don't stay there anymore. That's why you see chicken and a biscuit in the the pantry. You know, Obama's not going flying into the Overlook for a nice little stay and eating some chicken and a biscuit. They used to stay at the Overlook. If the best people still stayed there, they wouldn't be hiring some schmuck like Jack to take care of it over the winter. And I think that's sort of a commentary on America, is that you think the best people in the world are running, are moving here? No, right. They used to, but they left, you know?
Right.
They're in Ireland, dude. Or like wherever. They're mobile. They're global.
Right.
Because that's the whole Room 237, in that America was the alchemical melting pot, and that the formula runs for 237 years.
Yeah, but their smartest people, a.k.a. Stanley Kubrick and his family, like, made a decision and left the country and never went back. Yeah, except they did go back. I mean, like, he keeps that myth about him. I mean, they had apartments in New York. They had apartments all over the place.
Well, why did he not film on the real streets of New York for Eyes Wide Shut? Why did he build a complete set to simulate New
York? Thought they flew.
If you lived in New York, you'd understand.
I thought they went. They did the whole thing away from New York, except for they actually went to New York and shot a scene there for that movie.
Some of the exteriors are shot in the real New York.
It had to do with the travelings of Dr. Bill. That's the reason he built the set, so that when Dr. Bill moves around, it won't make sense.
And moving back in your
memory. That's right. It had to be a
in your memory of the place. And New York is one of the most nostalgic, place-oriented places in the world. I mean, everyone talks about the old New York, the New York that isn't there anymore, like... The Greenwich Village is the battleground. I mean, like, it's gone through so many changes. And it is Greenwich Village now is kind of like the Overlook. It, like, hey, all the beatniks used to be here, but now it's like three generations have gone by of people who don't care. There's no glamour left. Like, everything that you thought was great is gone. And that was Kubrick's stomping grounds. He was like a chess player. Washington Square Park, you know, like, I'm sure he's just like, well, New York's just not there for me. New York is in my mind. I'm like, I could be anywhere, and I'm going to just be in England. Home of the language, you know.
He comments to that. He says, I still read all the magazines, the newspapers, I watch the films, that, like, to be in America isn't necessarily to be there physically. That what America had become is sort of on this different plane. That he could live physically in England, but he could get everything that there is to get out of America still. That it
media through media and
through memory. Media,
yeah, recreations.
Well, it's like
America is just a cultural idea. It's a set of memes and, you know, things like that that are just sort of floating out there. It's not completely haphazard. There are, you know, obviously a lot of marketing firms that are spreading this idea. You have globalism, you have all these things where people are making a very specific attempt to export those ideas. But at the same time, I have to agree that is the America is an idea. And it used to be the idea of America was a good one. The idea of America was a land of freedom, the idea of, you know, a land of opportunity and tolerance and all these sort of things. And now the idea of America is its Hollywood, is its media.
You know, when he says this is the home of the jet set before anyone knew what the jet set was, that's a reference to, like, the people who would fly around on jets, right? Who, like, had private jets and they'd just go from fucking place to place. But then those people are also known as the quote-unquote beautiful people, which is what the Beatles were referencing, and the beautiful people, and also Marilyn Manson with the beautiful people. You know, that's kind of interesting. Like, and to think about, like, the gold room as, like, the gold rush, like, what America was in terms of what was the value here, and how, like, basically everything is kind of, like, we're removed from the excitement and everything that, you know, like, that was kind of, like, it's lost its value or something.
You get older and, you know, if you want beauty, you got to look at young people, you know.
Hey, and David, I'm glad
Kubrick was the master at it. I mean, like, the women that were in Eyes Wide Shut are all amazing. All of them. characters all knockouts. Totally. Seattle Pass casting that thing. They're all like really interesting. Like you, if you follow the careers of like the Eyes Wide Shut girls, it's fun.
Mm-hmm. I don't know, David. I'm glad you brought up the idea. You said the Beatles and Marilyn Manson.
Yes.
And I really want to go in that direction just briefly, is to say that this guy Brendan sent me his videos. He's at youtube.com/circusworld, CIRCUSWERLD. And he did these like mashups of the Beatles and Shining. Now, he calls it Yellow Beetle. And my mind just sort of went in this, I wasn't exactly sure what he was trying to get at with it, but it did take my mind into an interesting direction. It was something that I thought of that you told me. So basically, at the beginning, Jack's driving a Yellow Beetle. Now, I've seen this being compared. He drives to going to the Sun Road and all this sort of stuff. And you have this dung beetle as on representing moving the solar ball across the sky, all this sort of stuff. But then we can take that to the Beatles as a yellow beetle, being with the Beatles, also a yellow submarine. And it's in that car where he talks about cannibalism and, you know, this idea of he, of course, kills his family. And I realized that you said the Manson family said that they called their place the Yellow Submarine.
Yes.
So this idea that it's the Manson family lives in the Yellow Submarine, so the idea of we all live in a Yellow Submarine, is this correlation between the Mansons and the Beatles and Shining.
Sure.
But you're talking about Marilyn Manson, but I'm thinking, you know, Charles Manson, the Manson family. And then even Marilyn Manson, who gets interested in a lot of these ideas and plays with some of the esoteric concepts, and even some of the he's someone who's interested in the King Kill concept from Downard and so on. And that's another big piece of this for me. John, in your recent things, you make the point that Jack is there from till May 1st.
Yeah, right? if you apply, like, well, I take a leap of faith and say that the movie takes place in 1977. Just based on like the position of the moon in December in 1977 was interesting, because like there's a full moon on Christmas
but where do you get the May 1st date? Because that's when the season, the Overlook season starts, right? Is
the May 15th? Confrontation with Lindy, he talks about like, I'm responsible for this place until May the 1st.
Okay, so okay.
Maybe there's a two week orientations.
Right. But here's what I'm getting at. He's there until May the 1st.
Yeah.
So hold on. Marilyn Manson, King Kill, this kind of concept.
All right.
Mort d'Arthur, the idea is that King Arthur has this bastard son who's going to kill him, and that son is born on May 1st. And
King for a day, you know, the Wicker Man.
Yeah, what King Arthur does is he commits a genocide. He kills every child born on May 1st. He pulls a total fucking Passover thing where he says, wait a second, this child that I have out there, this bastard child out there born on May 1st is going to kill me. Hell no, I have to stop the prophecy. And he sets out to kill every child born on May 1st, which, of course, he kills all these children except for his own. So this child will then overthrow him. So here we have this idea of Jack wanting to kill his children and kill his family, bring us back to Manson family, all this stuff. But this May 1st date, and it's actually Danny who kind of lures him into the place where he dies.
But yeah, you know, it coincides with the savings time. It's just too perfect. Hey, guys, I actually have to split, but I'll leave you with one funny real-life sink story. involving our synchromystic yellow submarine here. Our car got hit like about a month ago. Like we came and there was a note on the, and the note said like, I saw someone hit your car, you know, like this is their license plate. And, you know, we looked at the bumper and there was like yellow paint scraped all over and kind of a dent, you know, but it wasn't like that big. And I was just like, I don't want to get involved. And, but then I kept seeing this yellow car around the neighborhood and I was like, ah, so I was, you know, I would see it leaving. And then another day I was like, oh, it's parked there. I'll go and check. And sure enough, like this, it wasn't a Beetle, unfortunately, it was a Ford Focus, but you know, it had the yellow paint as the ultimate clue. And like, sure enough, there's a matching dent on their bumper. And then, I was like, well, you know, he obviously lives in the neighborhood. Like, I'll just wait around until I find this person, you know, and see this person coming out of the car. And then one day I did see that person. It's kind of like, you know, big dude in a white t-shirt lumbering in right into, you know, my street. So I was like, ah, well, one day I'll see him again and I'll see where he lives. And guess where he lives? He lives
in your backyard.
Well, he lives right next door to me in suite 237.
Awesome.
No, in the one like house that's obviously modeled by the same person that has the same like arrangement as my house.
Nice.
It's just nice. Anyway, I gotta split. I gotta make lunch for the kid, and I will see you guys on the internet.
Thanks, yeah. John.
Yeah. Big blast.
So, John.
All right, I'm going to stop this recording real quick and then start the recording again, and we'll do part 3, okay?
Yep, great. Thanks.